When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Leona Abraham Brando, Blog Talk Radio host for Shedding Light. We have on with us today a few very special guests, and their names are Lynn S. I'm sorry, because I have something blocking my vision here, so I'm just going to try to get this thing going. Hold on a sec. We have on with us Holly Coleman, Retta Sunblad, and again, we have on with us Lynn Espejo. I've had a few calls here from a couple of prisoners, one in Massachusetts and one in Ohio. So it's been kind of crazy because this many calls kind of interrupted me when I was talking. So, Lynn, do you want to come on and introduce yourself, and then we'll have Holly and Retta follow you?
Sure.
I'm really sorry about this. Starting off kind of rough here, but we'll get it together. Okay, we'll start with Lynn.
Yes, my name is Lynn Espejo, and I live in Arkansas. I served 27 months in the federal prison system. I went to an 8-day jury trial, so I've seen the system from, I feel like, every angle except for probation, since I'm now serving time on home confinement on an ankle monitor. I recently was released during COVID-19, and I'm still serving my time at home. I have a blog site called Inside the Walls, where I blog my way through prison. I also host a radio show called Inside the Walls and Beyond, which focuses on women's issues as they journey through the injustice, criminal justice system. And I served time at Bryan, Texas, and I was stuck at the Oklahoma Federal Transfer Center during COVID-19. I feel like that my claim to fame in the prison system was that I became very knowledgeable of BOP program statements, which is policy, and that enabled me to help many women fight false incident reports and retaliation by BOP staff. Thank you for having me on again.
Thank you for being on, Lynn. Lynn was on with us yesterday with Miriam Jacobs from the Netherlands and also Sandy Fries from Indiana. And I was very impressed with all three of them. We had so many good responses. So I really am honored to have Lynn back on with us. And Lynn, do you want to introduce, we'll start with Holly. Holly, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself? Okay.
Hi, yes. Hi, everybody. My name is Holly Coleman. I am a former felon inmate at Victorville. I had a 21-month sentence. I did 13 and a half months at Victorville camp. I did 2 months, 60 days in solitary confinement for writing a women's blog on safety while there at Victorville, and 3.5 months on home confinement, even though I qualified to go to home confinement. I was never sent home. I'm currently a paralegal with the Dallas County Public Defender's Office. Because of my experience, I also run a business called Pink Lady Prison Consultants, because when I was inside, I saw so many women and so many things that your attorney doesn't prepare you for, and it's definitely a needed thing. And also, I'm a criminal justice reform advocate. I believe that most everybody that is in a camp should qualify actually for different types of program. Most need rehabilitation. Most people need mental health counseling. Let's take that money and put it where, by putting it in programs. So you can see prison system changed my whole outlook on what I wanted to do, and it is to help women. So, Lenora, thank you for having me on today, and thank you, Lynn. Lynn and I knew each other basically when she was going through her sentence. So,
thank you so much, Holly. You know, we have a family beyond a family. It seems like sometimes when people go to prison, everybody backs away. It's almost like they have poison ivy. The individuals are pretty much left on their own, and their family and friends kind of like back away because all of a sudden the pride gets in the way. They don't, you know, they're embarrassed about it, or they just weren't there in the first place. So it's like making a new family. Women and men who are incarcerated become close to others who are going through the same thing. Advocates out in the communities become family because they're all working on the criminal justice reform issues and other issues involving prisoners. And then you have the families of prisoners that do stand by their loved ones, and they're out and making families with the families of other prisoners. So it's almost like a new family circle. But anyway, thank you so much for being on, and we'll be hearing more from you in a few minutes. And we'd like to hear from Retta.
Hi, my name is Retta Sundblad, and I'm from South Carolina. I served time with Lynn at the FPC Bryan in Bryan, Texas. I served 24 months there, and then I served 6 months at Carswell Medical Facility in Fort Worth, Texas. I was the first woman released from Carswell due to the CARES Act. I'm 64 years old. While I was in prison, I received my bachelor's degree. It's never too late. I graduated from high school 45 years ago and received my bachelor's degree. I'm currently working on my master's degree in Christian counseling, and I, too, am a criminal justice reform advocate. I also am trying to provide support for ladies getting out and the families getting out. I'm on home confinement right now. I have until April 10th when I will come off home confinement. I'm busy trying to put together a program where I can start a support group here in the Greenville, South Carolina area for the families of those incarcerated. And I thank you, Leona, for having me on the show. And thank you, Lynn, for calling me and giving me the opportunity. And hello to you, Holly. Love ya.
love that. That's the family I'm talking about. But, but I want to thank you. Red, I want to thank you also for being on with us. Now, we have another caller. I believe it might be Pastor Dawn. Can you please state your name? Well, either they can't hear or they can't speak. So we're going to start the show now. I don't know if any of you have had an opportunity to hear the interview that we had yesterday with Lynn. You know something? I got two calls today just before the radio show started, and they were both from prisoners, one in Ohio, one in Massachusetts. And it threw me off because I was trying to schedule for two others, young men that went into prison when they were young in their youthful years that are now out and are going to also be scheduling for an interview. So all of these things came within about 20 minutes before the show started. But I wanted to ask if all of you listened to the show yesterday with Lynn and also with Miriam Jacobs from the Netherlands and Sandy Fries from Indiana, because they talked about all the issues that are going on in the penal system. And Lynn was able to share so much because she, being a former, not only being a former prisoner, but also being a wrongfully convicted, she had a lot to share about her experiences. And I'm sure you girls, Holly and also Retta, probably have gone through a lot of the similar situations, which I'm hoping that you'll be able to talk about today. But one of the things that they mentioned is the injustice that goes on in the penal system. So before we get started, I just wanted to let everybody know and let the audience know that as of January, for the whole month of January, we have started a project where everyone's going to be calling, at least making 3 to 5 calls a day, every day for the whole entire month of January, to the media outlets, to the politicians, to the ACLU, to the Department of Corrections, to the Attorney General's offices, to wherever and whatever you want to call them about. It can be about the injustices. It can be about solitary confinement. It can be about abolishing life sentences. It can be about women and what you went through while inside. But whatever the case may be, we want everybody to participate the entire month of January 2021 to make daily calls around the country about any issue of injustice that you see fit or that you want to get out there. And let's hope and pray that everybody participates so we can see some changes. And the media is always quick to side with those in uniform and those in the prison that are overseeing. They're not as quick to talk about the injustices that goes on between the incarcerated men and women, the wrongful convictions, the life sentencing, the first-time offenders who are serving life sentences and life without. So these are all issues that we want to address this month, coming up January 2021. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to leave this to you, Lynn, to get everything started, and we will just be listening.
Okay. Thank you for having us on again, and I appreciate Holly and Retta coming on. These are two women that I have a lot of respect for and a high regard for, and I think they both have a lot to contribute to the criminal justice reform advocacy of the criminal justice system. I think they both in their own right have a lot to offer. And like Holly said, I had met Holly before I self-surrendered to prison due to her work with inmates trying to prepare them to go into a self-surrender situation into the federal system. Holly was very vital in giving me information that helped me to feel, I guess, as comfortable as you can in that setting. I don't know that you're ever comfortable self-surrendering to prison, but the day that I self-surrendered, I do recall the Uber driver, my husband and I, where I went to prison was roughly 500 miles from my house, 8 hours. So my husband and I flew in to Bryan College Station. And when we flew in that day, of course, we had to get an Uber driver, believe it or not, to take me to self-surrender at prison. And I'll never forget it. I even took his picture because I said, when I write my book, I'm definitely going to have his picture in there, because he really delivered me to the prison system. He was very shocked to find out that people actually walked into prison. I guess that is kind of interesting that you are allowed to self-surrender. But at any rate, I did serve time with Retta at that prison camp. She and I worked in the reentry department for a while together, and we saw a lot of things in that department that I think is something that needs to be brought attention to, that we're not preparing women to go back into society. We're not really, there's not really any types of information that's helpful to women in those areas. But that's the way I know the two women that I have invited on today. And since I have been out, I have done some podcasts, Retta and I both have, with Holly, to try to bring attention to different types of topics that have to do with women in the prison system. I know Holly has Pink Prison, Pink Lady Prison Consulting, and she helps women, again, like she did me, prepare to go into the prison system. Holly has also, and Retta both, co-hosted with me my radio show. And again, these are women that I feel like are trying to bring attention in their own way to not only the injustices within our system, but also to advocate, like Holly said when she came on, to advocate for changes within that system, because we are locking entirely too many people up in this country. We're locking entirely too many first-time offenders up in this country. And as you know, we talked yesterday about the psychological effects of that, and we're not helping people to become better people by locking people up and putting them in the situations that we experience while we are behind bars. For instance, Holly, I would like for you to tell the listeners about your time in the SHU and how you ended up in the SHU and what brought all that on and the treatment you received at Victorville in California at the camp.
I would be happy to share that. It was a horrible experience. And actually, you even touched on it yesterday about solitary confinement and what it does to people. So while I was at Victorville, I was actively sending out email. We have email correspondence. Sent that out, basically running my own blog at the time. And there was an incident on the complex where I served time. They have a men's a penitentiary and two men's medium security facilities. So because of the men's classification, the women do all the work camp level. So I was working for the warden, and he was actually stabbed when he had gone to what we call mainline with his lunch, and they airlifted him. And I was locked into the front visitation room, and I was seeing the response as to the officers coming, dropping everything, jumping in the back of pickups, having shotguns, have their guns, weaving around these women who are out working, just leaving them and almost hitting several of them. And I thought, what in the world if they dropped a gun and shot an inmate? You know, nobody's going to care. Nobody would care. They would just write it off as part of this process. So as I watched this and the buffoonery that ensued, I wrote about it in a blog. And, of course, the Victorville complex did see the email go out. It was published, and by that time it was public knowledge. It made the news, it was on radio, but it didn't matter to the prison. The FBI was investigating now this particular incident, and it looked very bad.
Did we lose you, Holly? Hello?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
I'm still here. So what it ended up happening was that I was given an infraction, a 100 series infraction, which is basically akin to killing somebody inside at a prison because I put the lives of the officers in danger by letting the public know.
Let me interrupt you right there and point out to the listeners that do not understand the system what Holly is telling us. Holly blogged about an incident at the prison. Okay, so she told someone on the outside and had it posted. She wrote up what went on. She then received what is called an incident report. Other people, the name that prisoners use is shot, meaning she got in trouble for actually letting outside of the prison knowledge of what was going on. Holly, take back up where you were.
Yeah, and I need to stress this. It was had already also made the television news and on radio. So it was public knowledge at this point. It wasn't that I exposed anything. It was public knowledge. So I was
and a 100 series shot is a lot.
It's
the highest shot you can get.
Yes, it is the highest infraction that you can get. And with that came, they decided that they were going to put me in what they call the special housing unit, the SHU. And there is no SHU located on Victorville. They contract with the San Bernardino County Jail at that time. So I was transported to the jail process and thrown in what we call the hole. I was put in solitary confinement. That means the lights are on 24/7. There it's freezing cold. You do get room service, meaning they drop your lovely little meal right outside your door. But in the system, they don't tell you, because you're a federal prisoner at a local county jail, they cannot give any information. So I had no idea how long I was going to be there. I was there for 60 straight days in solitary confinement. I saw the outside for 15 minutes twice, and that's something that you're supposed to be let at 1 hour to be able to walk, breathe air, and that did not happen. So that was most difficult for me. Now, the kicker to this story is that on the 60th day, my unit team manager and the secretary came to pick me up, and they brought me back to Victorville. The issue is that when an inmate is gone for more than 30 days from a facility, you have to be reprocessed. As I was going through the reprocessing through and speaking with a psychologist, she could not find any record that I had an infraction or that I was gone from the camp for 60 days. There was nothing.
So they covered it up. So the BOP covered it up.
They covered it up. They covered it up. And every time at that point on, yeah, not surprising whatsoever. And after that point, when putting in Bureau of Prison forms, it's a way you process or request anything. I was requesting a copy of the infraction, so I had it, and there is nothing to this day. So with what I went through and seeing the injustices and then being treated the way I was, for something that, you know, I had to pull back. My family was very frightened for me. They didn't want me then to blog anymore or let anything out. So as soon as that, I transferred into basically the halfway house and then supervised release. It was my destiny to see, because all these women that are in there, again, to me, there is no rehabilitation. It tears families apart. It is very difficult. There's so many restrictions on each of the different processes, meaning when you're at the halfway house, when you're on home confinement, when you're on supervised release, and beyond what the felon moniker happens for jobs and apartment, and also for any assistance.
Oh, absolutely. It is a system that keeps you beat down forever. Once you have the felon mark on you, unless you could get a pardon, you are pretty much marked for life. I do agree that it's a continuous.
Holly, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You said Victorville?
Yeah.
Is that the one in California?
It is. This is the one that's in San Bernardino County, High Desert. Yeah. It is a complex.
When I first started New Vision Organization, we did national work, and we did work with prisoners in Bakerville and in Coalinga State and hospital, and we worked with those in Susanville and Victorville. I was wondering, is that a male and female prison?
It is. It has a women's camp and then a men's penitentiary and two men's medium security prison. So because of the men's classification, again, they cannot go outside of the prison to do any of the work. So that's why they have a low-level camp, so the women can do the entire work for complex. So, yes, it is a men and women. Mm-hmm.
Because I interviewed not too long ago DJ Vodica, who was a CO at I can't think right now. But anyway, he exposed a lot of his peers. He wrote the book on the Green Wall, and he spoke a lot about the injustices that were going on in the prisons there. But that wasn't at Victorville. But I know they had a male prison in Victorville. So I was just curious as to whether they had both women and men.
They do.
Holly, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
After being in solitary confinement myself, basically, for 3 months at Oklahoma and not seeing outside, not being able to see light, anything, that we didn't even have a window, what kind of anxiety or depression, or did you have any after effects? Because I spoke out about the anxiety and PTSD that that situation has caused me. But
Lynn,
my question to you is, what did
you
have?
Lynn, you and I talked about that. So it is the level of being in a small space, just the anxiety. I almost lost my mind because we didn't have books or anything. You don't know what time it is. It's just that whole shock to your system. So, yes, I have issues where it comes to being in smaller enclosed spaces, shocking noise, yelling, lots of yelling. Anytime I hear somebody consistently yell, it just kind of grates on you. It just makes you very nervous because it always worried me about what's happening to somebody that's next to me. Is that going to happen to me? Am I going to die here? Those are the things that go through your head. It is horrific. And you lose sleeping is still, and mind you, I have been out now for years.
It's called psychological torture, and it's happening.
Absolutely.
It's gotten even worse.
But you have to learn to recognize those things. And I've been very fortunate enough to being working where I do in the public defender's office, that we have a mental health group, that I'm able to take some of that material and go, yes, this does work, and this is the things I got to remember to do some self-help. So, and Lynn, you went through, I mean, the things, and it will stay with you. It doesn't just go away. It's PTSD.
Oh, no, I've been home 7 months, and I'm still having major issues with it. And, again, I have a mental health background before going to prison. I can't even imagine how people deal with this that don't have those coping skills, because I really believe I would have worse psychological damage than I do had I not had the knowledge of those coping skills.
I agree.
Retta, you served time with me at Bryan, and I know while you were there, you had a lot of beefs with the medical department. That was something that we mentioned yesterday as well, is that in the federal system, like, for instance, at Bryan, where Retta and I served, there's not even a doctor. You're being treated by what is called a physician assistant, who, by law in Texas, I've looked it up since I've been home, by law in Texas, are not supposed to treat you without direct supervision of a doctor. We had doctors that came and went. One day they would come to the camp maybe every 3 months, and it would never be the same doctor, hardly ever. They were military doctors that I'm assuming the prison borrows somehow from the military, and they come in, like I said, once about every 3 months. Sometimes we didn't see them for 6 months, but we had no doctor overseeing these PAs who were prescribing medicine for us. Well, that's if you could get medicine, but they would prescribe the medicine. They, you know, were the ones that you saw when you went to sick call and paid your copay to go to sick call. And for those listeners who are shocked to hear that, yes, in the federal system, you are required to pay a copay to see the doctor, even though you are the one locked up and taken away to their facility where they're supposed to take care of you. At any rate, we had PAs there at Bryan, and I will say not very good ones, unfortunately. The medical care there I felt was very subpar, and I compare that with what I saw at Oklahoma at the transfer center, where there were doctors and there were better health care people there. So I feel like I have at least something to compare to. And Oklahoma is only a transfer center. They do not really house inmates, except for the few men that they keep there that actually do the work within the prison. Like Holly was talking about, it's always the inmates that do all the work for the prison. But that is the only inmates they house. But yet they had such a better medical there than what we saw at Bryan. But anyway, Retta, tell us a little bit about your experience with Bryan with the medical.
When I came in, I had been on Social Security disability. The federal government had deemed that I was unable to work any job doing any position. I was examined by federal doctors in order to get my rating on disability. So I came to prison, and I went to my own doctor before I came, and I brought a stack of my medical records, a stack of the prescriptions that I was taking, and I walked in the gate, and they went to transfer me in, and the PA, a male, he wasn't even a PA, he was a nurse, a male nurse there. I walked in, I says, I brought these for you so that you will understand what I need. And he looks at it and he says, what are these? And I says, well, these are my medical records. I said, I called the prison and they told me to go ahead and bring these in. He picked up the stack of them and he threw them in the garbage can. I was taking about 15 medications at that time. I had uncontrolled hypertension. I have a herniated disc in my back. And I was taking, just due to the anxiety of the prison situation, I was taking an anti-anxiety medication and a medication for depression. So I get in there, and they gave me nothing. It took about 24 hours, and I was down at the unit. They were preparing for count. I stood up for count, and I passed out. You know, they took me down there, and they said, well, what's wrong with you? And I says, well, I says, probably the fact that you're not giving me any of my medications. I says, I brought them in for you. And they informed me that I could have forged those, and that's probably what had happened. They would determine what was wrong with me. I had a case worker who said, you're going to go work in the kitchen. And I said, I'm not able to do that. I says, I've been on disability. I'm not able to do that. She says, oh, no. She says, everybody works there for 90 days. And so I went over there. And in the meantime, the medical department started calling me over for tests. I went back to the kitchen, and the correctional officer over the kitchen looked at me and he says, I know what's going on with you. And I said, I beg your pardon. He says, you're just playing a game. I says, he says, there's nothing wrong with you. I says, oh, I says, where did you get your medical degree? And he says, listen, you're too smart for your own pants. He says, I see you have a no prolonged standing order. Well, I decide what is no prolonged standing. So you'll stand until I tell you, you can sit down. And so I listened to that, and then when I got back to the unit, I went to my caseworker, and I said, I've just been threatened by a correctional officer. And she says, what? And she says, I think you heard wrong. I said, I heard nothing wrong. And so she sent me over to the lieutenant's office, and the lieutenant said, who do you think threatened you? And I said, it was the correctional officer in the kitchen. And he threatened he was going to work me to death, because he did use that term. He said he would decide how long I could stand, and he was going to work me to death. So he says, well, he says, if you feel like you're in danger, then we'll have to send you to Waco, which is their shoe. It was a county jail. I think it's a couple hours away. And
that's the shoe at Bryan. That's the shoe. Let's let the listeners know that, Retta. That is, again, like Holly pointed out, at Victorville, there is no on-compound shoe. So they have to ship you off to a county facility. At the time, what Retta's telling the listeners is that was Waco, Texas, some probably hour and a half, 2 hours from Bryan, Texas, from the camp we were at. Sorry to interrupt, Retta. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's fine. And so I said, okay. I mean, I'd only been in prison for a week. I said, ship me. And he says, well, do you know what I'm telling you? I said, sure I do. I says, I just got here. I says, I don't care. I've got to serve my time somewhere, so if I need to serve it there, fine. I says, but I'm not going to be threatened by this guy. So then all of a sudden his attitude changes when, you know, he saw that I wasn't going to back down. And he says, well, how about if I go over and talk to him? I says, okay, you can go talk to him. I says, but I'm not going to be threatened. So he went over and he resolved the situation. But in the meantime, I had to file administrative relief time after time against the medical department. I arranged to have my medical records sent in directly to the medical department, and after the first 500 pages, they called me over and they said, you don't need to have them send any more records in. I says, oh yeah, I says, you need those records, because they have to read each page and then sign it. So I definitely made a little work for them. But once that transpired, I was able to get my medical needs met, and the PA and I came to an understanding that she was going to believe what I said, and I was fine there. Now, when I went to Carswell, and like Lynn, the medical care at Carswell was very good. I didn't have any problems at Carswell. Don't know if I had all my problems at Bryan, and they sent a note up there saying don't mess with her. But, yeah, I got good medical care there. In fact, you know, they were more than willing to recommend me for release under the CARES Act. And as I said before, I was the first woman released from Carswell. Unfortunately, the lady in the room next to me, a pregnant woman, Andrea Circlebear, died of COVID while having her child.
Yeah, that was really awful that happened.
Yeah.
There's many horror stories.
What upsets me about that case is, and I don't know, Leona, if you know about this case, this is out of Texas. She was a Native American. She was, correct me, ladies, if I'm wrong, around 7 or 8 months pregnant when she was made to self-surrender during, or was taken either one way or the other, made to go to Carswell, Texas, to the federal camp, that far along in her pregnancy during COVID-19, okay? So a federal judge, knowing she was pregnant, knowing her situation, knowing that COVID was ramping up in the prison, and mind you, Carswell was one of the first camps to have a lot of cases, or the, one of the first, not camps, but FCIs, I think it was, women that had a lot of cases of the COVID early on. And
more than 500 cases.
There. Yeah, she was still sent there.
There's a, on Friday and Saturday, Chinupa Guhamani does a radio show, co-host, and he had some women on there, and I believe that they were talking about that at one of those interviews. I believe they mentioned something about a woman that was pregnant and some injustice,
yeah,
because they talk about these issues as well.
And if
but
I can
you imagine that she was made to go?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, the House Judiciary Committee actually discussed this on December 2nd as well and did acknowledge her death. And because the Bureau of Prisons still refuses to put any information really out upon her. So they were questioning that.
That is true, because we did watch that on C-SPAN live. But just the point I was trying to make on that is, again, this goes back to there is a sentencing chart, there's a sentencing guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Judges sometimes are strapped. They don't have enough leeway. I think this newer case that just came out on December the 2nd, which is, correct me, ladies, if I'm wrong, USA versus McCoy, has given a little bit more leeway as far as what judges can do on compassionate releases. But we need more leeway on what judges can do on sentencing and on the front end. I understand that the sentencing guidelines are supposedly there and that judges have some leeway, but judges do not feel they have the leeway. There's been many cases out there that you read about where judges even told the person being sentenced, the defendant, that this amount of time they felt was ridiculous for the crime, but that they were basically held hostage by this sentencing chart, because if they didn't do it, the government's just going to go appeal it. So, you know I saw this in the federal system. With the federal prosecutors, it's always about a pound of flesh. They cannot let it go. For instance, right now, both Retta and I both have a, and I'm hoping you don't mind me talking about this, Retta, since it's public record. We both have motions into the court to get off the ankle monitor and go on to supervised release right now. I'm asking for 4 months early. Retta's asking for roughly 3. Retta has a situation with a family member that needs her care. I'm trying to finish my master's next semester, and it's very hard to do an internship to finish your master's where you have an ankle monitor on that you cannot hide. These things are huge. I don't even know why they're so big in this day and age of technology. However, even in those situations, the government is more than happy, Leona, even after we've served our entire prison sentence except for this part on home confinement. We are already home. We're not behind the walls any longer. They still don't want to give up.
Mm-hmm.
They want to
mm-hmm.
file things
mm-hmm.
and just continue to beat you down. It's a never-ending cycle. And I know yesterday we talked briefly, just for a little bit, about the barriers to reentry for female and male as well, but I focus on female issues. I know Holly and Red and I, all three, are educated women with support systems we had still in the free world. Holly and I both, well, Red, all three of us are married. Retta's husband did serve time due to her case, neither one of Holly or my husband have ever been convicted of anything or in prison. So maybe, Retta, you had a little bit different reentry than the two of us, but you still had a home to go to. You still had resources to go home to. There are so many women that I met in my duration of incarceration that do not have the benefit of you know, what Holly and Retta and I all three have. And it's a hard road even for women that do have those resources. But the women that do not have them, you know, they are pretty much thrown back in out of prison with no rehabilitation. The programs that the prison is offering in the federal system are either fraudulent or pretty much non-existent and are basically on paper only. They're all fairly much, for the most part, inmate taught. You know, so it's not a system that prepares people that maybe have actually led a criminal life and maybe did so to support themselves because that was their only means to support them and maybe their children or their drug habit or whatever the case. We are not helping people prepare to reenter society. And as I spoke about, you know, when we first came on, Retta and I got to know each other because at Bryan, she and I worked in the office that is called Reentry. Now, that office is the office that is supposed to give women information to prepare them for reentry into society. However, the most we really had in there was some information that wasn't valid or was very old and maybe a little help with a resume. Okay, that is not sufficient to help people. Some of these women have been locked up, I mean, 10, 12, 15 years. This is, you can't just give someone a resume and send them out on the street. It doesn't work that way. And not only that, you didn't prepare them with any type of, you know, rehabilitation, background, any new types of job skills to help them when they do go out into society. Not only that, if they've been locked up that long, technology has passed them by. And yeah. I can tell you, the stuff we had at the federal prison, even though I know, Retta, you tried to teach a lot of classes. I know I did as well. Holly, you may have at Victorville. I don't know for sure. But I was teaching QuickBooks, which is an accounting software to women. And the software that they had me teaching that class with was like from 2008. What good is 2008 software, and we were in 2019 when I was teaching that class? It's ridiculous. And, Retta, you know, I know you taught several classes that, you know, trying to help women prepare to answer the felony question, I remember was one of the ones that I thought was a good class that you taught that was probably helpful. But still, yeah, what were your you know, other classes that you taught?
I taught a class on codependency. I also taught one called Breaking the Cycle of Abuse. I taught how to keep your marriage together. One of the things that I discovered was that the women's prison is teaching women how to be single parents, which is fine and dandy, but it's not offering them a way to keep their families together. And, you know, the fracturing of the family, you know, has been proven to lead to criminality and incarceration. And so God just laid it on my heart that we needed to teach women how to develop healthy relationships. And so that was, I think that was a class that I was most proud of there, you know, being able to teach women a marriage. And it was a faith-based class, but I was most proud of that class. I think the thing that really got to me, though, was you worked for the former reentry coordinator when you were there, Lynn, and I saw a lot of good things that you were doing while you were there. I know there were resumes, you know, coming out the door left and right. When the new reentry coordinator came in, he decided that we were not to do resumes. He said that they needed to do their own. And I said, listen, I said, a lot of these women don't even have computer skills. They don't have a high school education. I said, how do you expect them to be able to do the resume? He said, well, how would they do
not
it
only
out
that,
in the world? And I said,
yeah. I was just going to
say, well, they didn't have access either. Because only a few of us had logins and accesses to the computers there. I had one because I had worked in reentry. You had one, I guess, because you worked in reentry or and had done some classes. But that was my question was, how are these women who don't even have access to a computer going to do a resume, much less know how to do one?
I was just going to speak on that because one of the things that I did when I ran New Vision Organization nationwide, We ended up helping the prisoners to write their resumes. I typed up letters for them to take to the thrift shops, to bring the thrift shops the letter asking them to donate some clothing so that when these prisoners, when these clients went to apply for jobs, they not only had their resume, but they also had clothing to go. Holly or Retta just mentioned something about so much talking going on. Something about faith-based. Was it Retta or Holly that mentioned it?
That was Retta.
Okay, Retta, you mentioned faith-based. And one of the things I would suggest is maybe rather than teaching people how to do things, to start a faith-based 501c3. Once your organization is found or your foundation is established, then go on volunteersmatch.com and go on unitedway.com and apply a post for volunteer law students, post for volunteer child development, students, post for psychology majors, post for even medical students, because they will gladly do their internships with you. They will gladly do the volunteer work. It can be virtual, it can be personal, it can be physical. But the thing is, once you have that organization, you help them with the resumes. You help them to get established. You write letters to the thrift shop and give the letters to your clients so that they can go to these thrift shops. And the thrift shops were allowing the clients to pick out $40 worth of clothing.
Mm-hmm. Goodwill was doing that. It was a partnership, yes.
And
I've
then
seen
you can
that.
Go,
that is awesome.
That's an answer. That is definitely an answer. Mm-hmm.
Then you can go into
Holly,
the community. Go ahead. It's your show. I'm going to let you run this. I can't.
I know.
Holly, did you teach classes too or no?
I did. I did. I took women's wellness and a couple of others. And, again, these classes are great. And the women that most inmates teach these classes. So the important ones, like what you've done, Lynn, the reentry, it's just the resources on the inside, it's really hard to help anybody because it's just archaic. One thing I want to remind everybody on listening in is that there has been no programming since March due to COVID. So you've got women that are, locked in their units right now. There is no movement or very minimal movement. So access to programming, RDAP pretty much has, which is the recreation, drug, and alcohol program. These are, very important. That one is a very important program for these people, and it's been limited just with COVID. So I want people to understand that these aren't necessarily being offered right now. And so we're in a really bad shape.
Quite frankly, the prison system is glad to use COVID as an excuse not to let people
absolutely.
Go home.
And they are.
I agree.
And they
don't I agree.
That, they lose their workforce. You have to also remember that there is many, many companies that have that contract with prisons that use inmate labor very cheaply, and with people going to getting on compassionate release and going to home confinement, they've lost their workforce. And this is something that the BOP director, Mr. Carvajal, actually even stated to the House Judiciary Commission that he's lost 2,200 of his workforce. Now,
yes, he did state that. Another thing that we should bring out about him is the fact that, for instance, he sat there. There was many things he said that were a lie. Okay, and Holly, I know you and I and Retta, all three. I've talked with both of y'all about this because we all three watched it live. And when you know what is really going on inside the federal prisons, and especially when Rhett and I had just barely been home a few months, and in fact, the date that he was on up before Congress, I know I didn't have a GPS ankle monitor, and Rhett, I know you didn't either because you got yours after I did. I was called in after that. He stated before Congress that everybody had a GPS monitor on, and it was a lie. But there was many other things, Holly, that were way more egregious than that, that I know you and I were texting back and forth because we just could not believe the things he was telling to Congress.
Or lack of, because he was under oath.
Yes,
and
that too.
And so he could not give an exact number for anything. We'll get back to you. I'm not quite sure. But to make the changes, everybody always asks, you know, these families and loved ones and everybody out there, Lynn, you know, you get it all the time. You talk about this. And, like, I'm so glad you're doing the program in January to contact the ACLU, your senator, your local, every official. Then we put pressure on making change with the sentencing guidelines. That's how we make change because, you know, you get daily somebody saying that their loved one is sick inside, they haven't heard from them, what can you do, how can you help? There's just there's no medical, there's no nothing, there's no reprogram, there's no reentry. We do this over and over. So I'm so glad, Lynn, that you're exposing a lot of this on, and you're having this platform today because, again, the way for people to help is you got to shake it up on the phone and be present and have a voice. That's your voice.
Well, one of the other things that COVID has also done, like we just brought out, it has given the BOP their excuse not to do programming, which this also goes back to the First Step Act. We've seen how they have not implemented the First Step Act and what little time they are going to give inmates for programming anyway, which is minuscule. And so this is just another excuse for the BOP to drag their feet on letting people out sooner than later, because let's face it, it's all about job security for them. This is a vicious cycle, and it's made to pad the pockets of people that are politically corrected and those that work in the BOP system, and I've seen it with my own eyes.
I also wanted to mention that Lynn and I both had success with our personal senators in addressing some of the issues in the BOP. I firmly believe, had it not been for Senator Tim Scott's office, I would still be at Carswell.
We have another caller. Okay. We've had two callers calling in and dropping because they didn't get a chance to say anything. So I don't know. Would you like to state your name? Hello? Okay, go ahead. I guess they don't want to say anything.
Well, maybe they're just listening. You know, another thing, Reddy, you were just talking about the senator. Yes, I did get my senator. My husband actually contacted him and got him involved, but that was a little bit different situation. I was removed from a program at Bryan, Texas, that I was taking because I refused to sign fraudulent paperwork that said we got a certain amount of hours that we had not got. And I was already serving time for a fraud that I did not commit, and I told them at the time, you're asking me to commit a fraud. So it was staff was asking me to sign paperwork. And when I refused, I was removed from the program. I was removed from the program for 3 months while I fought to get back in it. I filed administrative remedies, which is the grievance process within the federal prison system. My husband got my senator involved, and I continued to blog about the corruption that I saw at the prison system, including my removal from that program. 3 months down the road, I continued to file administrative remedies, and finally it came to the point they had retaliated, staff had against me. They had thrown me in the shoe for blogging. Of course, Brian didn't have a shoe, so they could only keep me in the shoe they had in the lieutenant's office for a few hours, and then they had to let me out. they really could not ship me to Waco because they would have been violating my civil rights to freedom of speech, and they knew it. But they thought they could intimidate me and shut my mouth by putting me in the SHU, making threats, shaking down my locker and taking my personal property, just making it hard for me on the compound. They wrote me 3 false incident reports, of which I beat all 3 of them. And at that point, I think they came to understand that there was not much they were going to do to me to make me back down, because I had not backed down after all of that. So, in fact, I would only write them up more when they would retaliate. So finally, they made a deal with me to put me back in my program, because apparently the regional office had gotten my complaints. And while they had not answered them, they had gotten with the prison and told them, hey, y'all need to do something here. So, in other words, they were going to rule in my favor on it. They wanted the prison to do that, though, without them ruling in my favor. And I think a lot of that came from the pressure from my senator. But I was allowed to be back in the program after 3 months. And the deal they made with me was that I would take back those admin remedies that I had out there on that particular issue at the time. And I think that had to do more with them not wanting me to continue up the chain of command and let Washington, which would have been the next step, know about their fraudulent program. So not only, Leona, are there minuscule programs in the federal system, there is also a lot of fraud that goes on within those programs, a lot of fictitious documenting of, you know, class hours and other things that aren't really taking place. So basically, even if you are in programming, you may not actually be getting the programming that on paper it appears that you are getting. But I do believe my senator was definitely beneficial in helping, maybe not helping with the issue, but just the fact that he was made aware of it and that he was asking questions was enough to make the BOP go, oh, hold up. Maybe I need to, I'm going to have to, you know, do something different here. So, yes, I agree that getting your families involved and getting outside people like Congress, senators, whatever involved, and there really needs to be an outside committee to, per se, police the BOP, because they're not capable of policing themselves. They're just not going to do it. You know, Holly, Retta, y'all speak up. What other egregious things did y'all experience? I know, Holly, you were somewhere different than Retta and I. What all did you see that goes along with this?
Medical, of course, we had issues with, you know, there was sexual abuse to an inmate. The degradation that everybody suffers with these officers. Remember, the officers that rotate through, I'm at a complex, again, that had 3 other men's prisons. You have that mentality of those three types of facilities or guards come in, and we're women. So they don't know how to separate the differences in how they treat the men versus the women, and it's just an abusive situation. I saw the medical care like everybody else did, which was just off the charts. There was nothing. I'm going to bring up Lisa Crow that was in Carswell, and I'm not sure, Retta, if you were there when she was. She had stage 4
yes,
cancer.
Yes. Right.
And Lisa Crow went through a horrific thing where they wouldn't even see her because they didn't want to have to deal with the situation, because then there was public scrutiny coming in, and they were basically just kind of wiping it under the rug. She was denied compassionate release based on the fact that the warden said that she was still a safety issue. This woman was in a wheelchair.
And she's at a camp.
Could get up.
No, she was at the FBI.
Yeah. And so but she is out now, but just it's just the lack of human decency. The indifference is astounding, where you have somebody that might be doubled over in pain. You know they can't get up. They're not faking it. And they're like, well, you know, go drink some water. Go lay down.
They
no
always say you're faking
care.
No matter what's wrong. That was their answer at Bryan. You were not sick. You needed to drink some water, walk the track, and buy something off commissary like ibuprofen, because there was very limited stuff to buy. And, Holly, I know both you and Retta both know that when I first got home, I immediately went to the dermatologist. I, too, like Retta, had taken all my medical records to prison, and they would not allow them. So I had my husband mail them in. Well, then they wasn't willing to take them because my husband mailed them. So he had to go get me to sign something, and he had to go to every doctor and have the doctor directly mail the BOP my medical records. Part of those medical records was my dermatologist, who I'm very fair-skinned and had been dealing with getting a precancer burned off of my face and body in different spots prior to going to prison, up into the time I self-surrendered, basically. I had just had some done the month I self-surrendered. And the dermatologist had recommended in the medical records that were sent into the prison that I needed to see a dermatologist at least every 6 months to possibly have more, because of I had been getting burned off every 6 months, spots that were, again, precancer, but that could easily turn into full-blown skin cancer. The BOP refused to take me to the dermatologist the whole 27 months I was locked up. I showed repeatedly to the PAs at Bryan, Texas, in the medical department, the physician assistants that we were forced to see. I showed them spots over and over that I knew from my experience of going every 6 months and having to have stuff burned off that were changing, that looked different than what the precancer things that I had had in the past looked. Sure enough, when I got home, I went to the dermatologist within 2 weeks of returning to home confinement back the first part of June of this year. They ended up doing 3 biopsies on me that day, and 2 of those biopsies came back as full-blown skin cancer. One was a basal cell, and one was another one.
Squamous cells, which are.
Yes, thank you. So 2 out of the 3 had turned into full-blown skin cancer due to the neglect of the BOP failing to recognize what they were looking at, even though I was showing these spots to them over and over, and these spots were gradually changing. It's lucky that I didn't have it all over my body, because I have had spots burned off. You know, one of the ones, I had 3 places, my leg, my chest, and my back. It was my back and my chest that had the full-blown skin cancer. The one on my leg ended up being benign. But that is just one example. When I was at Bryan, I know right before I self-surrendered, they had let a lady die because she had the flu, and they kept forcing her to go to work in the kitchen. And then she ended up with pneumonia. And I know, Retta, you were there when that happened. And then during my incarceration at Bryan, I saw several women that they continued to tell them they were faking. They let them get really sick. There was a woman in your unit, Retta, that had to have a tracheotomy because they let her get to the point that she fell out on the floor and was dying, basically. And a guard said, to forget medical, I'm calling. And called, and an ambulance came, and that's the only way that person got off the compound and got help. There was a lady in my unit that had heart issues, and they knew it. She went to the guard and reported that she felt like she was having a heart attack. They told her, medical told her, well, we're not coming down to the unit. You're going to need to walk, mind you, walk about a fourth of a mile to medical. She had a heart attack walking to medical. There was many other things I saw that weren't quite as egregious as those, but lack of health care, dental care, any type of medical care in the federal system is really bad. And I see people post online all the time that inmates get all this free stuff. They get the best of care. It's Camp Cupcake.
It's not true. I have to laugh because the American public is blind. You know, I have clients at every facility right now. It's what we're saying it happen over and over and over again. And if, like I used to say, if I had a cell phone with a camera, I don't care about talking on it. I just want something so I can tape you. Because if you could see it, it would just shock you. It would shock the American public. They'd be like, well, they were getting free food. They get three meals a day. They're getting medical care. They're getting these things. I know, everyone's like,
no.
No.
One of the things that happened, Retta, you were still at Bryan when this happened. The new warden we got thought that it would be a great idea to bring in 300 and something more women. Mind you, that's a whole nother third of a camp because when I self-surrendered, there was roughly 650. She brought in to where we had almost 1,000. However, the way the BOP works, and apparently the warden didn't know this or didn't care, was that their budget is yearly. So if you bring in 300 extra mouths to feed, you number one, you don't have the staff to help these women. You don't have jobs for these women. You don't have resources, but you also don't have food to feed these women. Were you there, Retta, when the food just every day would get smaller portions, smaller to the point that people that didn't have commissary were basically going hungry?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what's shocking again to people is everybody goes, well, how can that be? How can that the Bureau of Prisons have a business plan and not have the funding and say, oh, we're just going to ship this? They know good and well. Lynn, she knew good and well that she was going to do it cheaper, faster, better, didn't care.
Yeah, but quite frankly, they always have the funds for their staff parties every month.
Oh,
just saying.
All the time.
Yeah, steak and shrimp and fresh fruit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big screen TVs that went missing that were supposed to be for inmates,
washer
but yet somehow managed to go home with staff.
Yeah, I watched it.
But the thing about
that.
the food also, yeah. Retta, I don't know, Holly, if you ever worked in the kitchen, but at Bryan, the rule was you had to work in the kitchen for 90 days when you went there. Now, I got out before my 90 days because I went to work in reentry. And if you were going into education, reentry, anything where they had to have somebody, then that was a pass on your time in the kitchen.
It was the same rule of thumb, but I got my job with the warden, like, right away.
Okay.
So I didn't have
From working in the kitchen, I saw all the expired food that was being fed to us, plus the boxes that clearly stated on the side of the meat, not for human consumption. Retta,
indeed.
Did you see any of that when you were in the kitchen?
No, I stayed out on the floor and sat as much as possible. They were quite happy to get rid of me out of the kitchen.
So you never actually got to see any of the food items that we were putting out or any of the...
I was on the walker, and I just sat at the back of the thing, even though, I was being made to work in the kitchen.
I did see it. I saw it when the fact that we would be forced to go bag lunches. Men would go on lockdown. And so, again, there's the women to do the jobs. We were filling, sandwich bags, basically brown bag lunches and dinners. And I did see it. I saw a lot of things. I saw, disgusting insects. I saw filth.
Mm-hmm.
I saw, no matter how much the women would try and clean, you're not given bleach. The only two places they get bleach usually are, for the showers every once in a while. And so, I mean, you see things.
Bryan, I was in line at breakfast. And apparently there had been rat poop, for lack of a better word here, I'll just put it out there, in the oatmeal that they had already served, and many people had already eaten, and all of a sudden we're in line and they're announcing, pull the oatmeal. Sorry, ladies, no oatmeal this morning. Well, then, cellmates that worked in the kitchen tells me later, there was rat poop in it. We've had weevils in our beans.
Weevils and other food.
It was very shocking.
This is not at the inmates, the ones that are cooking in that. It's not their fault. It's not their fault.
They were told to cook it or they would get a shot.
Right.
And they were told not to let it out on the compound, too, because there was many times that the kitchen staff that run the staff of the kitchen were told and shown these things, and they told them, I don't care, cook it anyway. But there at one point, like I said, the warden had brought in roughly almost 400 extra women. I mean, all of a sudden the camp just exploded, and the food was literally. I mean, I had commissary, I was fine, but there was many women on
when
that
you
compound
don't have
that didn't.
There's nothing, and then you starve.
And they were very hungry. And a lot, you know, people that did have commissary, we had to help the other women because I'm not going to watch someone go hungry.
No.
And I will say that's a bonding experience that you have. You don't. Most women will share. We all did.
Yes. Yes.
It's a thing that you don't want to see somebody else going through. I mean, you'll share. You share what you have.
One of the other things I saw a lot of was staff talking ugly. We were called ugly names, cursed at, hollered at.
I laughed.
Wrote
false
shots. You know, they write false shots to inmates. And just basic overall mistreatment of inmates. And a lot of the men that came into the Bryan facility had been at USPs, which are United States Penitentiaries, a really high-level security. They had been at FCIs, which is also higher, or they had been at a low, but they had not worked in a camp setting. And not only that, they'd been working with men. And they came into our facility, and they had that attitude. They treated us, in fact, the captain told us one time that he was going to treat us like men. And I pointed out to him that, you know, the Female Offender Handbook, which is a BOP program statement policy, clearly states that you can't do that, sir. You cannot treat me like a man because I'm not a man and I'm not in a man's facility. And he didn't like that very much.
I'm sure he did, but Lynn, you have to use what's been published and what is a program statement to do that, and you did that well. They don't like it. We had the same thing. They came in and it's very, you know, they've been handling men at a certain higher level security. They don't know how to handle, you know, unlocking the door to help women to go in so they can cook in the morning. Everybody's just wanting to get through their day. These women we're not violent offenders. We're low level nonviolent. And we're women to boot. They didn't know how to handle that.
Right. Well, and again, they don't like you telling them about BOP policy because either my experience in the BOP is either A, they don't know it, B, they don't want to follow it, or they're just plain indifferent to it and feel like that there's nothing that you could do about, you know, the experience. So again,
and that's what I was directly told when I got my shot, my infraction, and I'm like, I'm going to fight this. And he literally got 2 inches from my face and said, "Who's going to believe you over me? Who? Who?" Yeah. So, and a lot of threats.
You know, we've had the situation at Bryan where Brett and I have been talking about, to where one particular unit there has been locked down now since before the first part of November, and we're not allowed to call, email, video chat, anything with their families, okay?
It's horrendous what's happening.
Yes. And they were locked down to where, you know, the other two units or other three units there were allowed to have those privileges. In fact, the prison tried to blame it on COVID, but yet if you looked on the BOP website, there was zero cases of inmate COVID within the system, so they say. Now, it seems that they have not even tested one particular unit there, and that is because that is the unit that they have had all the women doing all the jobs on the compound, and they don't want to know if they're COVID positive or not. So not only have they locked down a unit that had a lot of COVID cases that went to medical and it came out that they had them, but they will not test the entire compound to see what their real numbers are. So it's nothing but a cover-up, no matter COVID, no matter if it's just a regular day at the BOP. What I saw was staff fraud, misappropriation of money, like Retta said, the staff getting to enjoy cookouts and parties while the inmates had very little food to eat. You know, it's all about them and about what they can do to make you feel miserable and make you feel punished, because it's all about the punishment, not rehabilitation at all.
I agree. It's about the punishment. And they're really supposed to be there to oversee our confinement. It's not to continue the punishment. And they don't look at it that way, and they don't say it, even though it's just there to house us. And it's to give us our classes. The reentry piece needs to be there. All this money, remember, it's what, now $42,000 to $46,000 a year? And it doesn't trickle down to the inmate.
$80,000 for Retta and I. Because of my torn rotator cuff that I had before I went to prison, and I have a screw in my ankle from when I was 16 from a horse accident, I was on what was called remind me what it's called, Retta.
Care level too.
Yeah, but what they call it, something else. What is their name for it? Chronic care.
Chronic care. That's it.
I have those two conditions, and all they were giving me was meloxicam, which is an anti-inflammatory, and then I finally got a nose spray for my allergies towards the end of my sentence after I'd written medical up so many times. They finally just said, okay, whatever, what do you need? But that's all I was getting, a low-level anti-inflammatory, and they were calling me chronic care. They never called me up to check me, never anything. And yet they were getting roughly $80,000 a year to house me because they could say I was on chronic care.
Right, and it happens over and over with, like, everybody's – and my whole thing is it doesn't trickle down to the inmate. The money doesn't go into a program. Like I said, we have got to start getting a focus of going on the front end, getting these judges and prosecutors in the sentencing guidelines changed by contacting your senators to make a change, to the laws. So we're not housing these people. Take the $40,000, $46,000, put it into a program, have housing for people, even if it's a punitive thing and being in a halfway house and then having to check in and out. But giving the reentry skills, getting people skills if they are addicted for addiction, that's where the money should go. And then you're not going to have
Absolutely.
This recidivism, because that's all that's going to happen. But
listen, we saw people coming back when we were there because they mm-hmm. put people out without, again, reentry, no way to get housing, no money, no nothing. They put them out on the street, and if they don't have support system, I saw women that came back just in my 24 months at Bryan. I saw women, multiple women, that came back because they could not make it out in the free because they had no support system, and the prison system had not given them any reentry needs or anything to help with their needs or any skills to even work. And as we've talked about, there's already the outside people already have the negative on you because you've got a felony. There's already mm-hmm. all those barriers, you know, that's already in place because people are continued to be punished even after they serve their sentence in this country. It's a continuous punishment. It's a lifetime punishment. And, you know, in the case of white-collar people like the three of us, you've got, you know, you lose whatever licenses you have on the front end. Then, you know, you get prison time. Then you pay restitution. Then you're on supervised, you know, you're on supervised release. Then you still have a felony. You can never get a license again. It's just a continuous cycle. And for people that were, you know, drug, for instance, people with drug issues, well, they have other reentry needs to keep make sure they stay off of drugs. None of that is addressed. They don't get the treatment they need while in prison, and they darn sure do not get the after treatment that they need to make sure they don't go back to doing drugs and selling drugs to support, again, their living needs. So
I think one of the biggest atrocities at the women's prison is the fact that they don't deal with the sexual abuse nature. Now, I don't have any figures to back this up, but I would almost bet my life on it that at least 75% of the women who are in the prison have been sexually abused at mm-hmm. one point or another in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did take the
I think it's
trauma
a high
class.
Yeah.
the trauma
domestic
class,
domestic or
yeah,
sexual, mm-hmm. both, between mm-hmm. whichever.
The trauma class was very helpful. It was a group setting, and one of the classes we sat and watched a cartoon called Inside Out. That was very helpful. Another class we sat and played Jenga, because that was supposed
and
to teach
and
us how to deal with stress.
Let the audience know that you're being facetious, because we've talked about this. And from what Retta has told me, I did not take that class because I did not have the need for that class. But however, what you have told me, Retta, was the class was basically a joke. I mean,
yeah.
it was useless. And this is supposed
something
to help
that they got
women.
Paid for. Yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to help women. And it was taught by the same psychologist that, by the way, right before I got shipped away from Brian for blogging about their PREA violations, she's the psychologist that taught the trauma class. She's the one that they had in the lieutenant's office when they threatened me and threw me in the shoe for the last time that I was on that compound and told me that I was going to be shipped and so on and so forth, because she tried to make me take back my reporting of PREA violations. And as someone from the mental health side of the fence, I told her how unethical she was, because she is a mandated reporter of such incidents,
yes.
and yet she was threatening me and trying to force me to take back my reporting of it. And that's the kind of things that are going on inside our prison. That's why all these PREA violations, which is the Prison Rape Elimination Act, for those of our listeners that aren't aware of what that actually means, it is an act that was put in by Congress to govern the way women, well, men and women both, but to govern the way sexual abuse of inmates is treated within those walls. And we know, I know I saw it full-heartedly, that there was many PREA violations going on within the prison system. And it's, you know, it's widespread. Holly, I know you've interviewed many people and talked to people, you know, Coleman, Aliceville. I mean, I could just start naming all the women's places that's had, you know, lots of these violations, and nothing seems to happen to the staff that
no.
perpetrate these violations on the women.
14 women in Coleman sued, and they were denied, and the investigation basically stated that the officers left their employment early, and so therefore the BOP couldn't prosecute them. Even though
it's unbelievable.
It's just unbelievable. Some of the, of course, they're going to try and appeal it. But remember, even if they do win, it's the taxpayer dollar that is going to pay out. So, again, our lovely taxpayer family and friends are going to be paying something that an officer did.
Yeah, the abuse, the verbal abuse, the physical abuse, the withholding of, you know, contact with family, the withholding of food, the withholding, I mean, it's a vicious, vicious cycle that I don't think the American people have any idea what, you know, and again, this comes back to some of the things we talked about on the program yesterday. The psychological damage that serving time is doing to people, both men and women, is not making our society for a better place. I mean, if we're trying to lock people up so that they come back out better than they went in, we are failing 1,000%, no, we're failing 1,000,000% on that. And it's just a sad fact of our criminal injustice system from, like I said, from the start to the finish. You know, it starts with the prosecutor and it just goes all the way through. There's so many things that happen even at the halfway house level. So, you know, ladies, point out some more things, because, I mean, we haven't even touched on some of these things.
No, we haven't. Kind of overlooking. It's just starting from even the beginning, but I know we've been really concentrating on inside the prison, and again, right now, it is so bad with COVID and the indifference and the staff not showing up for work and locking the women in. When I say this, they're locked in their units. They're not able to go to dining.
They may get showers every 2-3 days a week. That's it. They may get access to the phone if somebody comes in, a staff member, and turns the phones on for them. They may be able to go in and maybe watch a TV program. They may be able to get out of their little cubicle or area to walk indoors in their unit. They're locked in. And this has been going on since March. So you have to think, it's even more locked in than what we experienced. We had a little bit more freedom at the camp. They do not have that right now. And
well, I experienced that whenever I was at Oklahoma, because there was times we went 5 or 6 days without a shower and locked in. And what you're describing is exactly what I saw there during COVID. It is it is definitely damaging. You know, when I got out, I had what's called fluorescent pallor. I didn't know there was a term for it until someone told me. But I was so ghostly pale and had lost all my muscle tone from not being able to get out of a little small cell, hardly any in 3 months, that, in fact, not too long ago, one of my youngest son told me that he is so glad I'm looking better because I scared him the first night I was home the way I looked. That's how bad I looked. I had not, because we didn't have hygiene there also, and we had a little bitty small comb that would not even comb through my long hair, I was not even able to shampoo my hair for 13 weeks. Because if I had shampooed my hair, I had no way to brush it. It would have matted to my head, and I would have had to have my head shaved.
Lynn, I was in same thing, same condition, solitary confinement, where I was let out maybe, was it twice a week, to use a shared shower, which had black mold in it, and the shower curtain was just completely caked in black mold. You just finally have to bite the bullet and take a shower. But it was the same thing. 60 days, I may have taken a shower 5 times.
Well, I had more showers than that in the 3 months. But
it was disgusting, yeah. But I had
but
no,
at Brian,
I had no
we had mold.
I had nothing. I had nothing.
We had a lot of mold at Bryan. We had worms, black worms, that would crawl up into the shower with us from the drain. There was rooms at Bryan that women were living with water standing a couple of inches on their floor at certain times of the year. It would actually come in to where they couldn't even get out, in and out of their bunk without stepping in, their whole foot being covered with water. And those rooms had tons of mold. The stuff I saw, I couldn't believe in a federal system.
Lynn.
And they say state is way worse.
Lynn, we have two minutes and 20 seconds. Would you girls, I wanted you to let the audience know about your Inside the Wall WordPress.
Okay.
So if you guys want to give the audience a little bit of information on how they can get in contact with you or your website, anything that you want to share.
Sure. You can email me at Lena Spejo. The last name is ESPEJO at sbcglobal.net. You may also contact me through WordPress on my Inside the Walls blog site. And follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Inside the Walls and Beyond. That is the radio show that I do that is all about women's issues. And I would be glad to talk to anyone. In fact, I had someone reach out to me this morning that I talked to that's about to self-surrender. Holly, tell them how to get in touch with you.
You can reach me at holly.coleman at pinkladyprisonconsultants.com. You can Google anything on Pink Lady Prison Consultants. I also can be reached at Holly, H-O-L-L-I, dot Coleman, C-O-U-L-M-A-N, at beyondthegame.biz.
Retta, what about you?
You can contact me at Rick and Retta. That's R-I-C-K-A-N-D-R-E-T-T-A. At hotmail.com. I'm in the process of putting together a website for our ministry, which is still standing ministry. That probably will come out the end of January.
Awesome. Well, Leona, we really appreciate you having us on today and letting us talk about these issues. What we have touched on today for your listener audience is really just barely grazing the surface of the issues that I know all three of us have talked about and saw inside the BOP. And again, we haven't seen everything because we were all three at the lowest of levels of security, which was the camp level. I did get a little experience at a higher level when I was at the Oklahoma Transfer Center and was handcuffed and shackled and flown on what's called CONAIR, which is the air system within the federal prison system. But honestly, I don't think we've even touched the surface of the issues that I would like to bring attention to and like to see change. And again, it starts with the prosecutor, and it goes all the way through the system. Retta, Holly, y'all have any final parting words for our audience?
I think as we look forward to 2021, just remember who's in control. It's not the government, it's God.
That is true. Holly, what about you? Any advice, any parting words? Did we lose Holly? Leona, do you have any parting words for our listening audience?
I am so sorry. I was on mute. I was saying Holly dropped. I just wanted to thank you girls for being on, and hopefully sometime in the near future we'll be getting you back on again. I don't know who the caller is that is still on with us, but I guess they didn't want to say anything. I just want to thank you once again, and our time has run out. So I am going to be closing the show now. I thank you again for being on an audience. We look forward to having you on with us again. I guess the next show is tomorrow with Chinupa Gluhamani from South Dakota and the Indian tribes from all over the country. So we look forward to that as well. Thank you so much, girls, for being on, and we are now closing.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Leona, and thank you for that advice you gave me. I definitely, I'll go back and listen to it. I didn't get it written down at the time, but I definitely will heed your words of wisdom.
Okay, thank you. Have a nice
day. All right, ladies, thank you so much.
Let me just shut down the... Me? Malachi?